dansant. Écoutez, répétez.
Well, I love cubism. It's my favorite style, and I see a cubist painting. Well, good morning. And this is Julie Bernard, and this is Art Focus, and hello again. I have an underwriter, and I'm going to read the underwriter's script for you right now. This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Cascadia Home Realtors, presenting a First Friday Art Quest show of anti-corporate and abstract art by Ryan Sherman, Mandala Art by Christine Claringbold, and live Brazilian movement of music from Rio Nights, Friday, January 6th from 6:30 to 9 p.m. at 7824 Southeast 13th Avenue near the Selwood Library. Details at CascadiaHomes.com. And that is the underwriting coordinator is speaking. Thank you so much. Okay, and thank you, Damali Io, for taking Art Focus while I was gone. I heard you were unusually intelligent in your presentation of this show, and thanks again. You're a lovely, artful person. I would love to have you take the show again anytime you might like to. And my guest this morning is Daniel Duford. Did I pronounce it right? Daniel
Duford.
Yeah. Thanks so much for coming this morning.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And Daniel has a huge and very wonderful show in the Merrillhurst Art Gym. And it's opening when?
The preview is Sunday, this Sunday, January 8th, and it opens officially on Tuesday.
Okay, now some years ago, Daniel, you were an arts writer for the Willamette Week.
That's right.
Yeah. I haven't forgotten that. And you did a fine job as the arts writer.
Oh, thank you.
He has majored in ceramics at the University of Hartford in Connecticut.
Right.
Okay. And you graduated summa cum laude in studio arts from that school?
University of New Mexico.
The University of New Mexico in 1990?
96.
96.
Yep.
Okay. And you do a lot of lecturing still?
A little bit. I'm mostly through teaching at the Pacific Northwest College of Art.
And so now you're at the Pacific Northwest the art school.
Right.
And you have but you do a lot of drawing and presentation of drawings, and you've had a lot of shows since the last time we spoke,
which was in
2002.
Yes.
Right. You did a wonderful piece called Gollum's Waiting, which was an outdoor installation for Pica in the empty lot downtown on 3rd and Taylor.
Right.
And that interesting things happened in that show, too.
They were vandalized, and, there was a lot of conversation about that. But actually, that piece, I think, is a precursor to this, in a big way, to this show.
Yes, it is a precursor to this show, which takes up all of the gym and the gallery next door.
Right.
Okay. You are calling this the sleeping giant.
Right.
Okay. And I'm going to have you describe the huge figures, and perhaps you can tell us what the story is or the myth.
Sure.
We were discussing the word myth. What does mythic mean? And you can do that, I'm sure.
Sure.
And so take over, would you please?
Okay. So Sleeping Giant is, as you said, it takes up the entire art gym space, which is the two small galleries and the large space. And Sleeping Giant is sort of the culmination of a lot of work that I've been doing since Gollum's Waiting, which I haven't been able to put into one space so everything can kind of connect. And so there's two main characters that kind of go throughout the show. One is this anonymous superhero who is amputated. He has a missing arm, And then there's the Sleeping Giant, who is a figure who is fairly new in my repertoire, that has trees growing out of his nose and trees growing out of his penis, and there's this kind of there's mythic references to that, of the Green Man or Jack of the Woods or the Golden Seed, those kind of things. So the kind of main formal trope that I use in the show is I play with scale. And so when you walk into the gallery, there are two large-scale figures that are much larger than life. One is 8 feet tall.
This is in the small gallery?
This is in the small gallery.
Okay.
And then the other one is actually 6 feet tall but seated, so he'd be much taller if he were standing.
Is this the Rodin-looking gentleman? And he's huge. Both of these figures are huge.
Yeah. And actually, those are... And another part of the show is that this is a bit of a conversation with my, as I was saying before, my intellectual past or my influences. So in those sculptures, Rodin plays very heavily, and so does Carpeau, whose sculpture, Ugolino and His Sons, which is a very famous 19th century sculpture, is the basis of the superhero that you see, who's sitting with his hands in his mouth, and he's very... he's just called the worried superhero, you know. So there's that figure, and then the other figure is the Great Bear, who is a reference to, it's actually a reference to a character in a graphic novel that I'm working on, but he's also a reference to the Bear Mother myth, which plays out in the next room. So when you go into the big gallery, you have almost every wall is taken up by large scale wall drawings, and then you have Townie, which is 19-inch tall wooden house forms, and on each side is a painted scene, and all of these are using again scale for the viewer. So when you walk in and you confront the drawings, there are sort of these historic heroic murals. Whereas then Townie, the small pieces are about these sort of quotidian town scenes. And so the viewer is a giant as he or she walks among the houses, but is dwarfed by the other large drawings. And then there's another small, in the small room is a piece called Skins versus Shirts, which are these little action figures who are in perpetual combat. And they're the antithesis of the giant sculptures in the other room.
They're very colorful, little tiny naked figures, and they're all having erections, or a lot of them are.
Well, some of them are. Most of them are.
They dance together. They're wonderful.
Yeah.
They're very bright. And I don't think a person could just have one. You'd have to have three or four, I think.
Oh, right. And, actually, it's interesting.
They play together.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because they're definitely referencing, collectibles. And that idea of taking something like a hero or an action figure, and then reducing it to this little toy,
and putting it into a little plastic, a nifty little plastic box.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
Oh, I was gonna.
Go ahead.
Well, I was that's that idea of heroism is probably the main idea of the show, and it's played out in the form of comic books and superheroes. And so you have the idea of the mythic hero, or this figure who is beyond reproach and is in the canon, who is sort of in the large scale drawings. He's in some ways out of scale for the scene. He's often defeated, and there's this. They're heroic, but they play against that heroism. Oh. And then in Townie,
he's very troubled.
Yes.
He's so big that he can't get himself, he can't really do very much, it seems like.
Exactly. And then there's one scene in which he's actually very small, so there's this idea of him always being out of scale.
Yes.
And part of that is I always think of, I'm a fan of comics and I like superheroes, but they're troubling characters.
Yes, they are.
Because they're...
I worry about them.
Right, yeah. Well, you know, if you think about what the if a superhero actually were in real life, say you sat down in Iraq, for instance, what would they actually do? They're in these costumes. There's these they have these powers which are kind of ridiculous, and so there's a way that they don't actually deal with the complexities of real life conflict. And I think one thing that runs through this show is the right now in this moment in history, there is as in America anyway, the dialogue, there is a lack of complexity, or there's a willful lack of complexity where we are trying to create a dialogue where there's good and evil and just that. And and life is much more messy, and I think that's what's going on with these figures.
Okay. Now, let's talk about the townies and their little houses. There's a drama taking place in each little house, and it represents a story, a bear story. What's the bear story? And I should say that these little houses are your typical little house. And how big are they?
19 inches tall.
They're 19 inches tall, and the whole house and sides and the roof and all are covered with these little illustrations of what's going on in this house.
Well, Townie is there's a couple things going on with Townie. One is that it's as a piece, it's a sort of a meditation on the idea of a town, and a town in American mind is the repository of all our moral values. So any politician will always say they're from some small town or they have small town values.
Yes.
And so a lot of our stories play out in these towns as if that's sort of the moral equivalent. The city is too corrupt. The wilderness is either wild or it's resources. And so Townie takes that idea of a this kind of civic bedrock of American society, and it starts to play out some of those stereotypes. But it's also in Townie. There's also I'm referring to it's sort of the origin, the story going on in there is it's the origin of these two characters, the sleeping giant, the superhero, and I'm using the Bear Mother myth, which is a Native American myth where two children are born to a human mother and a bear, and they become these kind of heroes for the tribe. And it has a lot of resemblance to Romulus and Remus. And so what's happening in here is I'm using the Bear Mother myth, but I'm also referring to Romulus and Remus as these two characters, or this town has dreams of empire. And so again, these are references back to the political moment, but also to other meditations on the town, like Sherwin Anderson's Winesburg, Ohio, and those kinds of things. And so the story follows these twins who are blonde and blue-eyed. So it's very, I'm playing that stereotype, the all-American boy.
Yes.
And as they
another
go.
Another little hero.
Right, exactly. You know, and they're always the hero. You know, when you look at traditional American narratives, they're always the hero.
Yeah.
And Captain America, for instance, that character is a blonde-haired, and then Superman's Smallville is this, you know, little Kansas town. So all those things are kind of going on in there. And it follows, the narrative follows not only the twins, but it goes from the beginning of sort of wilderness to taming of wilderness to the current moment of time. And what's happening with the images, I call it sort of a three-dimensional comic book, because there's a sequential narrative that happens between each image. So I have a sense of the order of these things, but there is a viewer doesn't know that exactly, and a viewer will come in at different points and they'll start to read relationships between different images.
And do you want to, I would like to put the viewer on the floor. I mean, you have to get down next to the floor to read these.
Exactly,
really.
Right.
Because there's close reading there, just like you might lay the funny papers out on the floor.
Exactly, right.
Okay. And then you can climb into this village yourself, and you might be a superhero.
Exactly.
Or you could be a tragedian.
Right, exactly.
Okay. It continues. Excuse me.
Oh no, and when one of the things that I'm interested in is our narratives that are fragments. And I think a lot about how we watch DVDs now, where there's always a section that has deleted scenes. So a lot of this show has the idea of what if you took just the deleted scenes, but you didn't know what the story was.
Uh-huh.
And so you have these fragmented images between the houses and each other, and then the houses and the murals. And so what happens is there's a kind of energy that happens in the space between those fragments, in which the viewer, you know, fills in what the narrative would be. And again, the viewer can come in from a different angle and have a backwards narrative, you know, from my intention. But I think there's enough clues I've left where one can get the sense of what's happening there.
Okay. This is KBOO 90.7 FM, and we're listening to Art Focus with Julie Bernard, and we're talking to Daniel Duford this morning about his exhibition out at Merrillhurst College. Let's talk about some of the people who are in the village.
Sure.
Because there's some grisly people in there. There are also some saintly people. The children are very interesting to me, how you've depicted them and what they're doing. That part of the story, can we go to that part of the story so
sure.
soon?
Sure.
Okay.
So there's the places where children come in. There's the beginning where you see the twins as babies or as little kids. Those are that first section. The idea is that each of those images of them as I'm trying to get at some sort of nostalgic American childhood.
Okay.
You know?
Yes.
And then later on, there are children who appear. Some of them taken from photographs. The way I work is I have a general sense of the kind of image I want, but then I start culling images from newspapers and from the web and from found photos, and then I use that photo in the service of this larger story, sometimes okay. not manipulating them that much. So then a picture of a bunch of kids from the 50s, it was actually his my father-in-law is a picture of him when he was a kid, and they're all in masks. I edit out some things, and it becomes a different kind of story, that picture, in the context of this larger narrative.
Okay. Now you have policemen in there.
Right.
And the policemen have different personalities.
Yeah.
Most of them, it seems to me I get the grisly side of the policeman there, but there are some sort of saintly policemen there too, aren't there?
Well, there's one
people can connect it to them.
There's one image of the two policemen holding an orange bundle, which is kind of a reference to an earlier image where one of the brothers has fallen to his death, and they're holding this bundle. But a lot of what's happening in there, the image of the police, a lot of those have come from recent riot photos. Some of them are from historic photos of different disturbances. A lot of what's happened in Towny is this undercurrent of violence in American life and in these kind of myths that we have.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. And so it's like redemptive violence that we all accept. I mean, we don't all, but I mean, I think popularly we accept that as a fact in our mind. And so I'm calling this into question, I think.
Okay. You have politicians in there.
Yes.
You have this awful guy with his hat on and his belly sticking out
right.
his shirt all kind of pulled down. His shirt is important. I don't know. The shirts on these people are sometimes very, they show who they are.
Yeah. Well, I should make a note about the because you mentioned when we were in the gallery the colors of the ties and the shirts. I use a really limited palette because
yes.
I was trying to mimic the kind of colors one sees in a comic book or old comics where
okay.
there was a kind of printing.
I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah.
I want to know. I want your opinion on the use of the foreshortening and kind of comic book style.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, As I said, I'm a huge fan, and as a kid, I grew up, you know, loving comics and reading them, and I still do, and make them, and so a couple of the figures are direct homages to certain artists who I really loved. One of them is an homage to Jack Kirby, who is a great he created a lot of the Marvel superheroes. And he sort of defined a certain kind of dynamism.
Marvel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Marvel Comics.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he created like the Fantastic Four and Captain America. And Captain America actually is, he's an inspiration in a lot of these things. So there's that. Okay. There's another very foreshortened figure, which is kind of a nod to another artist named Neil Adams, who I really liked, who came later on in the 70s. And so there's a couple things happening there. It's referring to a language, a visual language that everyone understands as comics, but it's also and then blowing them up to this enormous size. You know, normally a panel is very small, but it's also I think just for me as an artist, there's a kind of pleasure in being able to draw that, you know, and to draw it large and to have this kind of dynamism that the viewer can enter into as well.
Okay. if a person wants to get, you have to really get down to look at these. You have to bend over. And this is part of the story too, isn't it?
Right.
Is you becoming a huge figure among a lot of lively stories about people. You get down with the people, but you're above the people, and you're in a position where you could knock the whole thing over if you wanted to.
Yeah.
You could kick it, in fact.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's something interesting about that. Scale shift where,
yeah.
I mean, when you look at movies,
it's very important.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I think for the viewer to not only see it depicted, you know, in the different images, this idea that either gigantism or its opposite, you know, I think to have that, the viewer actually feel it in their body, is kind of an interesting way to expand the narrative, so that you have not only the visual happening, but also this kind of physical experience that you get from actually physically being among these small houses.
Okay, now among the small houses, there are some special dramas going on.
Yeah.
And would you talk about some of those dramas, or should I pick one out, or? I don't think I can because I didn't get down low enough.
Right.
I didn't, and I'm going to. A person should go to this more than once.
Yeah.
You will know that when you get into your car, you will realize that you need to go again a couple of times.
Right. There's a couple structures that I use. So there's 20 houses. And every four is a section. And then on the rooftops of the houses, which as a viewer you look down on, I have sort of the main theme of that section. And so there's one that's sort of the railroad, the building of the railroad, all the way to the disuse of the railroad. There's one that is floods. There's one that is memorials and graves. So all these things are also the... there's not only this in Townie. There's not only the story of the twins, but there's also the story that a town might have of itself, of its disasters, of its grisly killings, of its monuments, of its founders, and so all of those things are kind of playing out with and against each other in the imagery of the piece.
Yeah, there's always a history with the town.
Yeah,
and there's usually there are archives somewhere. Somebody has the archives, even if they're not stashed away in a particular building. There's some person has them. And if they don't have the written archives, they have it in their... Some old person has it in their brain.
Right.
Uh-huh. And so a town has a character, doesn't it?
Yes.
And When you're making these little houses, how do you make the, tell me the process of putting one of these houses together. They're all the same,
right?
Aren't they? And would you describe how you make these?
Sure. Actually, the houses were made, the actual physical houses were made, as well as the two sculptures during a residency I had at the Pacific Northwest College of Art in the summer of 2004. And I kind of came up with the design, and I had some studio assistants make
okay.
them.
Good.
Which is the one and only time I've ever had studio assistants. And so, they're very simple, paint grade plywood structures. But then I then thumbnail the whole thing out, the whole sequence out, in a notebook. Similar to the way I would do, you know, when I'm working on a comic or a graphic novel, so I know how the flow goes. But I didn't see the entire piece because my studio is too small to accommodate all of them at once. Uh-huh. I didn't see how the three-dimensional quality of them played out until I put it into the gallery.
So then I have
the thumbnails, and then I start to work on it. And then, as I said, I start to go through this collection of photos, or I go online and I start to do a Google image search, and I'll just find these images that are sort of floating around in the ether, you know, and they become part of this thing. Some of them I've made up, some of them I've manipulated, but I'm interested in that idea of where those images, you know, some hunter has posted an image of himself on the web, and so that becomes, he becomes one of the twins, you know, in a sequence, and I change the kind of prey he has or something, but I'm sort of bouncing images off each other within these ideas.
All right, and is there a neighborhood, or is the whole thing a neighborhood?
Yeah.
Is there a church and a grocery store? I didn't see any.
No, I think this is a general town, you know. I think it's sort of like it is a townness, you know. So there's no
town-ness.
There's a specific place.
Okay,
right.
Yeah, I get that. Townness.
Yeah.
Have you a parting word for us today? Because I do think that we should go over the statistics of how to get there and
sure.
where Mariehurst College is and everything. Can you do that?
Well, I just want to thank you for having me on, and I hope everyone can come out there. It really is an experiential piece in that I think one has to, as you say, go a couple of times because you have to be in the place to get all the kind of visual connections.
Yeah. I consider this a very important show, Daniel.
Daniel
Duford has been, did I pronounce it right again?
Yes.
You pronounce, say your own name. Daddy Julia is tongue-tied. It's Daniel Duford.
Yes.
And thank you so much for coming this morning, and thanks for this great show. I think it's an important show, and everybody needs to go and see this show more than once, perhaps. And Mariehurst College is a beautiful place to go. There's lots of grass.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of grass. And it's one of the few places around where you can see acres and acres of beautiful green grass.
Yeah.
And then there is this wonderful show. You can't miss it. And thanks again, Daniel Duford. And I wish you the best.
Oh, thanks, Julie.
You're a guy who can really draw.
Oh, thank you.
You don't know how much I appreciate that.
Thanks.
Okay, and so farewell for now. And this has been Julie Bernard and Art Focus.
Allons dansons.
Écoutez RPTS.
It is 11 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Also tonight at 5, it's the KBOO Evening News. The last half of the program tonight will be devoted to a call-in on your ideas for what you'd like to hear on the KBOO Evening News. So tune in for that tonight starting at 5 p.m. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Swahili Inc., specializing in contemporary and traditional African home decor and accessories, and networking with artisans in developing African nations to support economic growth and cultural exchange. Swahili Inc. is located at 128 Northwest 12th Street between Cooch and Davis in Portland, and on the web at swahili-imports.com.